Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231, and it is Wednesday, March 30th. So this is our last lecture before a test on Monday. This chapter is not on the test. So let's go over what is on the test. Make sure that we're on the same page. So exam 3 on April 4th. Is going to cover chapters 10, 11, 12, and 17. That's it. So what's that? Skeletal muscle tissue. That's an introductory chapter to muscle. 11, muscles of the body. 12 is fundamentals of the nervous system. And 17 is endocrine system. Okay, so those are the chapters on the test. Everybody's getting ready for that test. You know, it's coming up. Hopefully it's not a surprise to you today. All right, so we finished central nervous system last time, and so we're going to go to peripheral nervous system. So what is the peripheral nervous system? What's a good way of thinking of a peripheral nervous system? How would you describe that to somebody? It's everything outside the brain and spinal cord, right? So just say everything outside the central nervous system. That's a really good way of describing it. And the functional organization of the peripheral nervous system can be broken down into two parts. There is part of the peripheral nervous system that brings signals into the CNS, right? And we call that the sensory division or the afferent division. Or the other part is the motor division, which is taking signals from the CNS out into the periphery. We call that motor because it's gonna control effectors to produce some kind of response in your body. All right, so furthermore, the sensory division we can break down into two. Somatic means to your body wall, to your skin, to skeletal muscles. That's your somatic part of your body. The visceral part are all the parts that are deep inside visceral cavities, like abdominal cavity, pelvic cavity, thoracic cavity. So those are the two general areas of your periphery. Right? And motor, of course, can be broken down into those two same areas. Somatic motor means to voluntary skeletal muscle, because voluntary skeletal muscle is not contained in body cavities like the abdomen, right? It's on more the surface, the soma of your body. And so everything that's inside body cavities is going to be, the muscle is going to be either smooth or cardiac muscle, and the other thing will be glands inside various body cavities. All right, in terms of a structural organization, in order to take a signal from the periphery toward the central nervous system, there has to be sensory receptors. There are different kinds of sensory receptors that we're going to look at. And then when your central nervous system makes a decision on what to do with that information, it's got to cause a change in an effector or through a peripheral motor ending. So the slide on the right over here, we see sensory, both these red and blue fibers right here, okay, are coming in through the, these blue fibers right here are coming in through the dorsal root ganglia. That's the sensory root into the central nervous system. And then in the gray matter of the central nervous system, we have unmyelinated associations or interneurons that share that information and make a decision and send it out via motor neurons. And these cell bodies are in the ventral horn of the gray matter, and then it leaves the ventral root to go to various effector organs. So that's kind of the organization of the nervous system. And there are two ways that nerves can enter or leave the central nervous system. And it can enter or leave the brain, or it can enter and leave the spinal cord, because those are the two divisions of the central nervous system. Those nerves that leave the brain are what we call cranial nerves. And the nerves that enter or leave the spinal cord are what we call spinal nerves, right? So we're going to learn something about those different kinds of nerves. There are 12 pairs of cranial nerves, and there are 31 pairs of spinal nerves. These cranial nerves have names associated with them. We're going to learn their names. The 31 pairs of spinal nerves really don't have names. They just have numbers, starting with the first one. That would be number 1. Yeah, and the very last one would be 31. Okay, cranial nerves have numbers as well, 1 through 12, but they have also associated names with them. All right, so let's talk about peripheral sensory receptors first. All right, so these sensors are structures that pick up sensory stimuli and then send that information to the CNS via some kind of afferent axon. And there are two general kinds. There are free nerve endings, and there are receptor cells that pick up different kinds of sensations. And free nerve endings are what is used for pain and for temperature. And other sensory endings, the encapsulated kind, are for pressure or for mechanical deformation of tissue, or could be picking up light or sound or other special kinds of senses. So we can classify these nerve endings by location. Exteroreceptors are picking up energy or some kind of modality of energy that is outside your body. So touch, pressure, pain, temperature, and some special senses, right? Like vision, hearing, and balance are what we consider exteroreceptors. Interoceptors are measuring things that are deep inside your body, like visceral pain. Maybe you've had a heart attack or a cramp of a smooth muscle someplace. It's just a different kind of pain. It's not, it's a more dull pain. It's still as intense, but it's just not as sharp and searing as compared to somatic pain. Nausea, hunger, sense of fullness, these are sensations that are developed by interoceptors inside your body. Proprioceptors measure tension that's produced in muscles. So it can measure muscle length and tension, and also tension in joints and tendons as well. So it gives you a sense of body position. So even with your eyes closed, if I were to take your hand, you would let me to move your hand around. If I were to put it above your head, you could tell me, oh, my hand is above your head, my head, even without your eyes open, because you have receptors in various parts of your body, in all muscles and tendons and joints. And so these are what we call proprioceptors. So here is just a proprioceptor in a skeletal muscle that we call a muscle spindle that's used to help contract muscle to the proper degree and also protect muscle from stretching. And then here is another proprioceptor that we see in a tendon. This is what we call a Golgi tendon organ right here. And for instance, if you ever lift something up that's way too heavy, this is the organ that is going to relax this muscle. You'll drop that heavy object before it damages any joints or bones. All right, so again, it's important for protecting different parts of your body. So we call that proprioception. Okay, so let's classify different kinds of stimulus. Mechanoreceptors are important for touch, pressure, and vibration. You have these in your skin. You also have thermoreceptors in your skin. And I guess I can pull up a picture of skin. So here is a picture of your integument. So here are some free nerve endings for pain and for temperature. And you have cold nerve endings as well as hot nerve endings, so you can tell the difference between hot and cold. Here are some free nerve endings on this erector pili, which then measures movement of this hair right here, so you can feel like wind blowing over different parts of your body or even clothing rubbing on different parts of your body when it moves these hair follicles around. You have chemoreceptors inside your body for measuring various kinds of chemicals. So it can measure acidity when it measures hydrogen ion concentration inside your body. There are also other chemoreceptors for measuring glucose, because glucose is very important in your blood. Glucose concentration is controlled. And also calcium levels inside your blood, and the amount of water that's inside your body is monitored all the time. And water, don't forget, is a chemical. So chemoreceptors are necessary for that. And in order for you to see things, you need another kind of exteroreceptor. We call that a photoreceptor. Where do you have photoreceptors at? In your eye, that's right, and they're only located in your eye. And nociceptors you have pretty much all over your body. They just measure harmful kinds of events that are happening, whether maybe it could be too hot a temperature, or it could be damage to a tissue if it's ripping, or chemical exposure are going to stimulate nociceptors, and then you're going to move your body away from that damaging stimulus. Classification of receptors by structure, right? The encapsulated ones These we find in the skin, like the Meissner's corpuscle, Pacinian corpuscle, and Ruffini's corpuscle. Meissner's are located very close to the epidermis we see right here. These are for light touch. So for very light touch, you use these Meissner's corpuscles. Right. You also have deeper ones that kind of look like an onion right here. That's a Pacinian corpuscle. That's for deeper pressure. Right. And then here's another one that is encapsulated, and that's a Ruffini's end organ right here. Again, that's for deep pressure as well. Okay, so different kinds of receptors for different kinds of sensation. Non-encapsulated, we saw for temperature, pain, and also around hair follicles to measure motion of hair follicles. And proprioceptors, we talked about that just a little bit, like muscle spindles that are in muscles for determining stretch, the Golgi tendon organ to measure stretch within a tendon so that a tendon isn't overstretched, and then different kinds of receptors in joints for monitoring the stretch of joint capsules and the motion of joints so that protects your joints. Because remember, joints should only be used in a particular fashion. Right? Some are for flexion and extension, but you don't want to ever abduct and adduct. For instance, like the knee. You might want to flex and extend, but you never want to protract and retract the knee or abduct or adduct the knee joint. So these kinesthetic receptors for proprioception help protect joints from inappropriate motion. They give you feedback and pain inhibition when you use a joint inappropriately. Okay, so some of these receptors produce general sensation. Other receptors are for special senses. So I want to tell you the difference between a general sense and a special sense. A general sense is from a receptor that you have all over the body. Maybe a good example of that would be a temperature receptor. So if I were to take an ice cube and I were to put that on the back of your hand, could you tell me that that was cold? Sure. What about if I take that ice cube and put it on your kneecap? Could you tell it was cold? Or in your back? Or on your forehead or earlobe or belly button? Could you tell it's cold? Yeah, that's because you have temperature receptors all over your body, so that's what we call a general sense. All right, and also proprioceptors, it seems like a special sense, but since you have proprioceptors in every muscle, every tendon and joint in your body, right, you have these proprioceptors all over your body, that's a general sense as well. Okay, and so temperature, pain, you have receptors for all over your body, and vibration, that's why we call those general senses. Special senses, you can only monitor that modality only in one or two areas of your body. And a good example of that would be photoreceptors. Where is the only place that you can perceive light? Your eyes, two locations. And those are highly developed organs, so that's another thing that goes along with a special sense. You need special organs to sense these special senses. It has many, many layers to it, kind of complicated, so we're going to look at that in a couple chapters coming up. But more importantly, with a special sense, it's only really one or two locations. So if I were to take a flashlight and shine it on your earlobe, or your belly button, or your kneecap, or your elbow, would you see any light? No. You'd have to shine that flashlight just into your eyes where you have photoreceptors, right? So a special sense is only from just a few very localized regions on your body. So some of the other special senses would be taste. Can you taste with your fingertips? No, only if you put your fingertip in your tongue, in your mouth, right, can you taste anything. That's a sense of gustation. So taste is a special sense because you have receptors only in that one location. What's another special sense? Can you think of another special sense? Hearing, because you can only hear with your ears, right? If I ring a bell down by your toes and your toes vibrate, you won't hear a thing. It's only your ears, all right? So hearing, vision, taste, what else? The sense of olfaction or smell is a special sense. You can only smell with your nose. So you have odor receptors in your nose, and another couple kinds of special senses have to do with maintaining your balance or equilibrium. And those are located in your ear, pretty close to where you can hear things. So those are special senses as well. So the two senses, associated with equilibrium, our special senses. All the other senses are what we call general senses. All right, let's look at some peripheral motor endings. So motor means it's going to stimulate an effector to produce some kind of response in a tissue. And we talked about skeletal muscle already. Where the heck is skeletal muscle at? Maybe it's this one in here. All right, so we have a motor neuron. Yep, this is a good slide. So here we have a motor neuron coming down, and it's going to almost touch a skeletal muscle right here. So this is a synapse. Okay, so it's a cell-cell connection that's transferring information. And here is the axon terminus, and in that axon terminus you have vesicles filled with neurotransmitter. That's a signaling molecule that's going to be released by the neuron, which is going to move across the synapse and bind to receptors in the muscle cell, and that's going to generate an electrical signal on the muscle cell, which is going to cause the muscle cell to contract. Okay, so this is typically how, this is exactly how skeletal muscles are caused to contract, but smooth muscles and cardiac muscles are similar, okay, but a different part of the nervous system. The autonomic nervous system releases neurotransmitters on smooth muscle and cardiac muscle to regulate their activity as well. Okay. But on a skeletal muscle, that neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, and acetylcholine then is degraded within the synapse after it causes this muscle to contract, because you don't want this muscle to contract forever when acetylcholine is released. The enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine in the synapse is acetylcholinesterase, so that your muscle can relax so that it can be contracted once again. Okay, and does anybody remember what a motor unit is called? A motor unit, let me close that so I don't have to flip around. A motor unit is what? Is one motor neuron. And notice that it does not go just to one muscle fiber or one muscle cell, but it bifurcates or trifurcates and goes to two or three, or maybe even as many as 1,000 different muscle cells. So that one motor neuron can cause, in this particular case, two muscle cells to contract. In the red example right here, you see three muscle cells contracting. And like I said, it could be as many as maybe 1,000 muscles connected just to one motor neuron. So a motor unit is the motor neuron and all of the muscle fibers that it goes to. So depending on the amount of control that your body needs in a particular region, some motor units are very small. Okay, here we see two where you need fine discrimination, fine control, like maybe in your face and on your hands, other parts of your body. Okay, the motor unit is going to be very big. Maybe on your back for just contracting all your back muscles at one time just for posture when you're walking or standing, for instance. Okay, so which type of motor unit has more precise control, a small one or a large motor unit? The small, that's right, that's for dexterity, right? Few muscle fibers per motor unit gives you much better control. Okay, in visceral muscle, and visceral muscle is either smooth muscle or cardiac muscle, there are synapses as well. So neurons release neurotransmitter. Some of the neurotransmitter sometimes is acetylcholine, at other times it's norepinephrine, and these neurotransmitters will have opposite effects on the effector organ. So for instance, on the heart, norepinephrine will speed the heart up, but acetylcholine, on the other hand, will slow the heart down. So they work in opposition to each other. Now, does that sound like a kind of a waste of time, or is that a good thing to have things working in opposition to each other? What do you call it when things work in opposition to each other? Antagonism, right? And antagonistic systems are very important when you need to have precise control and balance over an important body function. Just like in your car, what's the function that's controlled by an antagonistic system? Your speed, right? And how fast you're going. You use the accelerator and brake pedal together to control your car. Okay, so we said that acetylcholine is broken down by acetylcholinesterase. Norepinephrine is broken down by an enzyme called monoamine oxidase. Sometimes we just call that MAO. So those are the analogs of breaking down neurotransmitters. Okay, so some nerves leave the brain to go to your periphery, like to your face or to your tongue in your periphery. What do we call those nerves that leave the brain? Those are cranial nerves, okay? And there are 12 of them, right? And they can be categorized into four different types. There are some that are purely sensory, right? Or purely afferent, like for vision and for touch and pain. And smell, these are purely sensory nerves. So information will only go from the periphery into the central nervous system. And some are motor, that go to skeletal muscles. They're like in the head and neck, and here are a number of them, 3, 4, 6, right? 11 and 12 are purely motor. And some are effector neurons that go to cardiac muscle and smooth muscle and glands, which are things you cannot control. You can't control cardiac or glands or smooth muscle. So they're a part of what we call the autonomic nervous system as opposed to somatic nervous system. And the autonomic nervous system from that very first slide I showed you can be broken down into two divisions. And they're antagonistic to each other, so that's good. One division is the sympathetic nervous system, and that means the other is called the parasympathetic nervous system. So there are parasympathetic signals that leave through cranial nerves 3 and 7 and 9 and 10 probably is the most important. Okay, so I would try to memorize 10 as being a very important. Now, what kind of nerve is nerve number 10? Is it a spinal nerve or a cranial nerve? We're just talking about nerves that leave the brain, so it's a cranial nerve, so cranial nerve number 10. Okay, and the fourth kind is mixed. It has more than one function, so it will have a motor function and a sensory function. So it has both of those functions as well. So when we get to cranial nerves, there's a lot of memorization, and so we would like to use some tricks to help us memorize a list of things. And so we're going to use a familiar phrase or something that almost makes sense, and then take the first letter of the letter in each of the words of that phrase and have it represent the first letter of a word in that list that you're trying to memorize. Like, for instance, the names of the 12 cranial nerves. So if you have 12 cranial nerves, how many words should you have in this phrase to help you memorize the correct order of the names of the cranial nerves? If there's 12 cranial nerves, then you should have 12 words in that phrase, which we call a mnemonic. Okay, so mnemonic is just a little phrase to help you memorize something. And you can go to this website right here, medicalmnemonics.com, and look up various mnemonics, and you can filter it out for muscles or nerves or for chemistry, chemical principles, all kinds of different things. And you can also filter it for the degree of, I guess, adultness, right? Like you can get X-rated mnemonics and things like that. But I don't want you to use any X-rated mnemonics in lab or lecture, right? So filter those out right away. But what might be best for you is for you to make your own mnemonic because it will have a tendency to make sense for you. All right, so here is a mnemonic that I really like. Okay, it's not one that's in your book. Your book probably has a couple. All right, but this is one that makes sense to me, and it says, on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop. So you might wondering, why does that make sense? Well, what is a hop? It's not a dance, like hip-hop. A hop is a grain that you make beer from, okay? And I guess people from Finland and Germany like to drink beer, so this is just a little saying, well, here are a couple people that are up on a mountain, and Mount Olympus is a very famous mountain in Europe, and it's looking over a number of valleys that are growing these grains to make beer from. And Olympus, of course, is a very old mountain, so, of course, this makes perfect sense. So, take the first letter of each of these words right here, and that corresponds to the first letter of the names of the cranial nerves. Right, and so we said there are 12 of them. They each have a number, right? But they also have a name. So the cranial nerve number 1 starts with an O, and that's the olfactory nerve. And furthermore, the way that they are numbered, let me show you the way that they are numbered. It's not probably too difficult to appreciate this. They are numbered 1 through 12, starting anteriorly on the ventral surface of the brain, and as you move posteriorly, right, so here's number 1, you just add some numbers to it. The next posterior one is 2, the next one is 3, and the next one is 4. So the only thing you really have to learn is how to use that Roman numeral, right? But probably we all know how to do that. What's the other kind of numeral that we typically use? Like the regular numbers. I don't have it on the sheet right here, but sort of interesting. I don't have a marker to write it. Can I try any of these? No. Maybe this number. What kind of numeral is that? Ah, what's that? 2. What kind of numeral is that? That's not a Roman numeral. That is what? That's an Arabic number, right? Okay, that's an Arabic numeral. So you guys know how to speak Arabic to some degree. That's pretty amazing. Okay, but for cranial nerves, we use these Roman numerals right here, which sometimes is cumbersome. All right, so the most anterior, what's the most anterior sense you have on your face? You have your nose. What is that sense of smell called? Olfaction, so that's the olfactory nerve. What's the most anterior sense organ that's on your head? Your eyes, all right? That's cranial nerve number 2 for vision. But what do we call that sense? That is going to be the optic nerve for vision, okay? And then oculomotor. This is a motor nerve that goes to the eye. It controls pupil constriction. Okay, so oculomotor. The next one is trochlear. This goes to eye muscles, to extrinsic eye muscles for you to position your eye around. So here is a partial list of functions of the cranial nerves right here, not the complete list. So this is what I would expect you to know for the lecture test, not the complete list that's in your textbook. Now, if you ever get into a professional program, like a nursing program or something, then of course you'll have to know the number of names and all the things, all the functions that these cranial nerves do, right? But this will get you going in the right direction. All right, number 10 right here, we said was important because it is a very important parasympathetic nerve, right? It goes to the heart and it slows the heart down. There are also sympathetic nerves that go to the heart, okay? And what would you guess the effect of a sympathetic nerve to the heart would be? If parasympathetic slows the heart down, what does the sympathetic nerve do? It speeds it up because the sympathetic and parasympathetic are antagonistic to each other. But notice that we don't have any sympathetic nerves in the cranial nerves right here. There's no sympathetic outflow from cranial nerves whatsoever. All right, so I like this little saying because we have what? On old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop. All right, so another really good thing maybe to ask you on a test, which would be easy, is what numbered nerve is the hypoglossal nerve? Okay, and by knowing that saying, then you could say right away, well, gee whiz, it's the last one, and now you know that there's 12, you got to say, oh, well, that's cranial nerve number 12. Right, so that's not terribly difficult. So just memorize this little saying or one of your other favorite sayings to know the correct order of cranial nerves and the particular function right here. Okay, so anybody have any questions on that? You have a question.
So the vestibular cochlear doesn't really make sense, right?
Oh, vestibular cochlear nerve. Okay, it will make perfect sense in maybe a week or two. Okay, when we talk about senses, because the vestibular cochlear nerve goes to the ear, and it allows you to hear. One part is for hearing, the other part is for equilibrium. So the part that goes to the ear is the cochlear division, that's for hearing, and the vestibular part goes to the other senses for equilibrium, which is another part of the inner ear. And the reason why it makes perfect sense is that another way to talk about hearing is what? Is auditory, right? So that it used to be called the auditory nerve. And so that's why this made sense, you know, a couple of years ago by putting and right there, because it used to be called the auditory nerve, But since then, they've simplified it to make it more relatable because it's going to the vestibule and the cochlea. Okay, so it's nice when they simplify things like that. But then the mnemonic doesn't quite make the right amount of sense. But you can see how in time it makes the transition very nice. Okay, so you can count these nerves down. So this is an exam figure, and you can just count number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, okay, and 6. The only little trouble is that number 10 comes back up to this little area right here on the medulla. But all of these cranial nerves leave the cerebrum or the pons or the medulla, but not from the spinal cord. Okay. So hence they are spinal nerves. All right, so again, some of these nerves are sensory, purely sensory, like the olfactory nerve and the optic nerve. And some have what are purely motor and some are mixed. And it's a good idea for you to know which ones are purely sensory, which ones are mixed, and which ones are motor. So here is another little saying to help you remember. So the first word represents what the function is. Okay, so S for sensory, M for motor, and B for both, which is what? Both sensory and motor go through these different nerves. And so guess how many words are in this little saying right here? Well, there's 12, because there's 12 cranial nerves. And here is the saying. Some say money matters, but my brother says big bucks matter most, right? So then you should be able to just remember that little saying on a test, figure it out, and tell me which one is sensory, which one is motor, and which is both. And guess what? You would like to know this, too, when you get into a professional program, because they'll ask you which nerves do what, which are purely sensory, and which ones are mixed. Okay, so that's the brain. Let's talk about some spinal nerves. Now, spinal nerves, we did talk maybe a little bit. How is a spinal nerve developed? Where does it come from? Where does a spinal nerve come from? Okay, let's look back at this figure right here. So here is a spinal nerve. Here's a spinal nerve. Actually, here is a spinal nerve. How does it originate? It receives nerve fibers from the ventral root. Okay, what's the function of the ventral root? I can't remember if we talked about that. I think we talked about that a little bit already. Okay, it's motor, right? So signals are leaving the central nervous system. And what about the dorsal root right here? This is purely sensory. So the dorsal root is 100% afferent, the ventral root is 100% motor, but notice they join together to form a spinal nerve. So what's the function of a spinal nerve? It is always going to be mixed, right? So it's always going to be mixed. We say it's mixed because it carries both afferent and efferent information, but the roots are either one or the other. Okay. And then the spinal nerve bifurcates into the ventral ramus and the dorsal ramus. So this part of the nerve goes to everything that is anterior to the spinal cord. The dorsal ramus goes to everything that's posterior to the spinal cord. And which ramus is going to be bigger if you look at it? Okay, and how would you figure that out? Well, just think about how much of your body is anterior to the spinal cord and how much is posterior. Is your spinal cord right smack in the middle of your body, or is it offset one way or the other? It's mostly what? It's posterior. So you actually have very little body posterior to the spinal cord, so you have very few neurons going there, so the dorsal ramus is thin because it doesn't have many nerve fibers. But the ventral ramus is going to be a lot thicker because it contains many more nerve fibers going to many more places of your body. Okay, so roots, medial to the spinal nerve, what do you mean by that? So here's the spinal nerve, and the root is what? Toward the midline compared to the spinal nerve, and do you see that these are medial to the spinal nerve? Absolutely, right? And they're either afferent or efferent, one or the other. Rami, on the other hand, okay, are always going to be mixed because they're composed of fibers from both roots. And as a matter of fact, if we look at a spinal cord model, a really nice spinal cord model like this one right here, okay, so here we see a root and a root. roots are actually composed of all of these fibers coming from these minor segments, right? And we call these rootlets. So rootlets leave the spinal cord, they converge to form a root, and then both roots converge to form a spinal nerve. And then the spinal nerve bifurcates into either the dorsal ramus or ventral ramus, depending on what part of the body it goes to. Okay. So make sure you know what the function of a ventral root or dorsal root is. And there's something else on this slide that will help you later on. So here's the spinal cord that's going through the vertebral canal. And on either side of the vertebral column, we see some other neuronal tissue that almost looks like little miniature spinal cords on either side. Okay, and sometimes, and we see a little bulge right here and a little bulge right here. All right, we also see a bulge in the dorsal root. What's in this dorsal root? It was just the previous slide. Yeah, let's go back to this. Here we see the dorsal root, and then here is that bulge. That's a dorsal root ganglia. So what do we have in this ganglion right here? Nerve cell body. So here's a nerve cell body of a unipolar neuron. So there's thousands in this area, so it forms a little bulge. And now why do we call this a ganglion? Because the definition of a ganglion is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in what part of the nervous system? In the peripheral nervous system, right? So this is a ganglion because it's a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. Okay. So if we look at this next slide over here, here is a ganglion. It contains a bunch of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And again, it's in the peripheral nervous system. It's in what we call the sympathetic chain ganglia because all these ganglia are connected together. And these are specifically for the sympathetic nervous system. Okay, and what does the sympathetic nervous system oppose, or what is it antagonistic to? The parasympathetic nervous system, and most of the parasympathetic nervous system leaves the brain from cranial nerve number 10, or the vagus nerve. Oh, I didn't tell you what vagus means. It might help you remember the name. Okay, let me go to... I think this slide right here is good enough. Oh, sorry. Down over here. All right, so cranial nerve number 10 leaves the brain, goes through your neck, and then it starts to bifurcate. It's not shown on this slide, but here's a picture of a body. It bifurcates and goes and wanders around everywhere in your body, bringing parasympathetic signals to numerous organs that are in your viscera, including your heart. Okay, so there's another name for a wanderer. Does anybody think of another name for a wanderer that starts with a V? You have to be like an English major to know this. But how about a vagabond? Okay, so that's actually how they name the vagus nerve because it just kind of wanders around all over from your body. But where does it come from? Way up at your brain, cranial nerve number 10, right? And then courses all over your body. Okay, for parasympathetic stimulation. Sympathetic stimulation comes from these sympathetic chain ganglia right here. Okay, that's not a cranial nerve, but when we get to maybe the next chapter, we'll talk a little bit more about the sympathetic nervous system. But it leaves, right, motor signals for the sympathetic nervous system leave the motor root, which root is that? The motor root is the ventral root, right, which is the anterior root, goes into the spinal nerve, and then it enters the sympathetic chain via what we call these two little bridges right here. These are the rami communicantes. So sympathetic signals enter the sympathetic chain, and they can re-enter at the spinal nerve right here and go to various effector organs through this other rami communicantes right here. This might be an exam figure, so it's probably a good idea to be able to label these different nerves, right? The different roots, the rami, the communicantes, and the sympathetic chain right here. So let's look at this question right here. What branch of a spinal nerves carries afferent and efferent information to your erector spinae muscles. Where are your erector spinae muscles at? They're in your back. Okay? So what branch carries signals to those muscles that are in your back? But what kind of signals? Afferent and efferent. So can that be a root or a rootlet? No. What does it have to be? It has to be a spinal nerve, okay, or a ramus right here. But what goes just to your back? Does the spinal nerve go to your back? Partly, but it also goes to anterior compartments as well. So what part only goes to your back is the dorsal ramus. And the dorsal ramus comes from a spinal nerve, so the dorsal ramus also has a mixed function. It carries both afferent and efferent signals. All right, so that's how you would answer that question. So if, like, you can almost see the answer is correct, but not quite, and you can formulate a question, go ahead and ask me a question. But since this is the first time you're looking at this, you might not even be able to ask me a question. Okay? Especially if you didn't do a pre-lecture reading assignment. All right, then probably you might be a little bit lost right at the moment. Okay, so there are some important nerves. All the cranial nerves are important for you to know something about, their name and their function and their number. Some of the spinal nerves in your periphery are important, and as a matter of fact, there are two that I want you to know something about. And we didn't even talk about these in lab yet, and some of you, there's one lab that still has to take the muscle practicum, but what is one nice thing about the muscle practicum? You only had to know the name of the muscle, the action, origin, and insertion. There's one thing you didn't have to know, and that was the innervation. Okay? You didn't have to know the name of the nerve going to a muscle, but here is one that I do want you to know something about. It's the phrenic nerve. It goes to a skeletal muscle, and it goes to a skeletal muscle that you use for breathing. What's an important muscle, skeletal muscle, that you use for breathing? It's the diaphragm. And is breathing important? Oh yeah, absolutely, because if oxygen is not being delivered to your brain, when do you lose consciousness? 3 seconds. And then when does your brain actually die? In 3 minutes, right? So that diaphragm is really important because it's helping deliver oxygen to your brain, which needs it to make ATP. All right, so the phrenic nerve comes from three different divisions or three different parts of the spinal cord, and that is through C3, C4, and C5. All right, so remember, spinal nerves are named after where they leave the vertebral column. All right, so here is C1. C1 leaves between the first cervical vertebrae and the occipital bone. And C2 leaves between C1 and C2, and C3 between C2 and C3. So that's how we name these spinal nerves, right? And if we were to continue the spinal nerve toward more medially to the spinal cord, what would happen to this spinal nerve right here? It would bifurcate into what? The ventral and dorsal root, right? To either enter or leave the spinal cord. So the dorsal and ventral root, right, form these segmental branches of the spinal nerve, and notice that all of these nerves, C1 through C5, form a network, right? And this network is what we call a plexus. This plexus is in what part of your body? It's in your neck. Okay, so I just meant really simple like that, or cervical region. So this is what we call the cervical plexus. All right, and I do want you to know why you have a plexus, especially here in your neck and in a couple other locations in your body. Okay, well, here is that phrenic nerve. And what did I say the origin of the phrenic nerve was? It is C3, C4, and C5. So here is C3, nerve fibers, and it contributes to the phrenic nerve. Here is C4, and we can see a contribution to the phrenic nerve, and then here is C5, and here's the contribution to the phrenic nerve. Okay, so this is a nerve that goes all the way down to the diaphragm from your neck, and this is the nerve that allows you to breathe. Right, so there's a little saying that will help you remember what the origin of the phrenic nerve is, and that saying is C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. Because if there's damage to the phrenic nerve, what's going to happen? You're going to stop breathing unless somebody knows CPR, right? That's the end of the story for that person, unfortunately. Okay, so what would happen to somebody if there's damage to C3? Will they die? No, because the phrenic nerve still can get information via what? C4 and C5, right? Or if there's damage to C3 and C4, maybe they're severed, right? But that person's still not going to die because innervation still can arrive at the diaphragm via the C5 spinal nerve, right? So the beauty of a plexus is that very important nerve signals can take alternate routes to get to important organs, right, without harmful effects to the individual, right? And I'm sure you use this principle maybe even today on the way to school. Maybe you have to take the 405 someplace, maybe from down south to get to the college, and you get off at Valley View or something. But what do you do as you leave the house? You turn on the radio and see if there's a SIG alert or something on the 405. And if the 405 freeway is shut down, what do? You take an alternate route to get to where you want to go, so you don't spend your day just waiting in traffic, right? Okay, so a plexus is just the way that important nerve signals can take alternate routes when there's damage to some particular nerve, right? So that's the beauty of a plexus. It shares information, and signals can take circuitous routes to get to important essential organs in your body, performing essential functions. All right, so that one that's real important is the phrenic nerve from C3, 4, and 5. Another nerve that I want you to know something about is the sciatic nerve. All right, and the sciatic nerve comes from a different plexus. You know, before I talk about that, maybe I'll show you all the different plexes that are in your body. Where are these located at? Oh, guess what? I don't have a picture with them all together. All right, well, we were looking at the cervical plexus. There's also one right here on the way to the arm. This is the brachial plexus. So you just have to know that this network right here is the brachial plexus, but you don't have to know the names of any of these different interconnections, all right, or where it comes from the spinal cord. You just have to know that is one important plexus in your body. Another is lumbar plexus. Oh, here's a nice zoomed in region of the brachial plexus right here. All right, so we're not going to be too concerned with the different parts of these different plexuses. Now here is, okay, the lumbar plexus coming from L1 through L5. Okay, and then the last one is the sacral plexus. All right, so here we see lumbar plexus, right, and then sacral plexus right here. So we'll have, lumbar and then sacral right in this region. So we have some models when we get to this in lab, and that's going to be easy to identify. Okay. Now in terms of the lumbar plexus for the sciatic nerve, I think we're going to have you recognize that in lab as well. Okay, the sciatic nerve, okay, comes from L4, 5, and also from some sacral, so I'm on the wrong slide. Let's do this one right here. So here's L4, 5. Here is sacral 1, 2, and 3. And what does this little CO stand for? That's the coccygeal spinal nerve. Notice that doesn't carry a lot of traffic, so it's very small. So here is the sciatic nerve, and where does it get its nerves from? Okay, we can see L4, 5, S1, and S2 all contribute to the sciatic nerve. Okay. So those are the four origins of the sciatic nerve. Okay. One last thing that I want to talk about in this particular chapter is a dermatome. All right, so here are all the spinal nerves. Here are all the spinal nerves leaving the spinal cord. Here's the cervical plexus, brachial plexus, lumbar plexus, and sacral plexus right here from each of these divisions. Okay, now, how many cervical vertebrae do you have? Can you remember? You have cervical vertebrae. So that's the bone that form your neck. So remember, you have breakfast at 7 o'clock, so you have 7, right? And then you got 12 thoracic and 5 lumbar. Well, if you have 7 cervical vertebrae, how come you have 8 cervical nerves? Because the first one comes off of the spinal cord above C1, between C1 and the occipital bone. All right, so since you have that extra little space right there, you have one extra spinal nerve, right? So you have 8 cervical, right? You got 12 thoracic, 5 lumbar, and 5 sacral spinal nerves coming out, and a couple of coccygeal, which makes 31. Okay, so these nerves go to different parts of your body, and it makes sense that cervical nerves innervate the more superior parts of your body, and the lumbar nerves innervate what? The more inferior parts of your body. But there is a particular region that is innervated by a particular spinal nerve, which has what? A very particular origin between a couple vertebrae. Oh, what's the name of that space between vertebrae that a spinal nerve actually leaves the vertebral column? So remember, the spinal cord goes through the vertebral canal. And in one vertebrae, that vertebral canal is made of the vertebral foramen. Okay? But what is the name of that foramen that allows nerves to leave laterally? And you have to put a couple vertebrae together to see it. That's called the intervertebral foramen, right? So each nerve leaves through an intervertebral foramen, which is made of 2 vertebrae, and it's going to go to a certain surface area on your body, and that's what we call a dermatome. So here's a dermatome. So both motor and sensory functions are shown on this particular map right here. So this part of your body on your anterior thigh receives innervation from L2, which is through that intervertebral foramen between what? Between L2 and L3. It comes right here. So this is a really handy map if somebody is experiencing pain or inappropriate sensation that follows this outline right here, or maybe some kind of motor dysfunction. Now we know exactly what part of the spinal cord is being damaged, right? It's just going to be at L2, right? But if it's this whole region right here, we also know that L2 and L3 and L4 are involved. Right, so this is just a way for us to figure out where to do some imaging studies of the spinal cord or vertebral column to find out where that nerve damage is. All right, so these are what we call dermatomes, and here you can see it on the posterior side. So when somebody damages the sciatic nerve, okay, let's look in the front over here. What did we say the sciatic nerve comes from? L4 and 5, right? You're going to find inappropriate sensation in this part of your thigh and your leg right here, okay? So it's going to be lower down in your limb when the sciatic nerve gets damaged. Here is 5, and here's a little bit of 4 down over here. Okay, so this is a nice way of being able to trace spinal cord injuries by looking at these dermatomes. Okay, so that's it for the peripheral nervous system. So what's going to take most of your time in here, probably just becoming familiar with cranial nerves. But just remember, the cranial nerves do what? Start anteriorly and then just count posteriorly, just adding 1, right? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then maybe using a mnemonic to know the proper name right here. So some important ones you said was the vagus. That's a parasympathetic nerve that wanders around all over in your body. Another one, let's go over another one. So we talked about the vestibulocochlea, that's for hearing. Okay, abducens, that's a good one. It goes to an eye muscle. Some of you have had the lab on the eye already, one lab hasn't. But for those of you that have, remember that there are some muscles that are attached to the eye, the globe of the eye, that can position the eye around without moving your neck. Right? There are 6 muscles, and 4 of them are the superior rectus, medial rectus, lateral rectus, inferior rectus. And cranial nerve number 6, we call this the abducens. It goes to an eye muscle. Now, what eye muscle do you think it goes to? It's going to make the eye do what? Abduct. What does abduct mean? move toward midline or move away from midline. So the abducens goes to the lateral rectus muscle that causes abduction of the eye. So some of these, once you look at this, some of these things make perfect sense. Okay. Okay, so the more time you spend with it, of course, the easier it will be on the test for you. Okay, I didn't pass the sign-in sheet around today, did I? Oh, well. Did I do that last time? I can't remember. I did. Well, I lost it somewhere. I don't know if somebody has it. So I'm not going to pass the sign-in sheet around today. So let's see what the next topic is. It's autonomic nervous system. So you know what? I think I want to start talking about that a little bit today so that takes a little pressure off of us the next time. Okay, so autonomic nervous system. So maybe go back to your notes on that initial nervous system chapter. Do you want to save changes? Okay. Okay, which had just the outline of the nervous system. And in there, you'll see that autonomic nervous system has two main divisions. Okay, and they are the sympathetic and parasympathetic, and they're going to be antagonistic to each other most of the time. All right, so this is chapter 15. And I want to go here. Anatomy, chapter 15. Okay, I think that's pretty good. All right, so there's two divisions to the autonomic nervous system. And autonomic nervous system doesn't go to skeletal muscles because those are under what kind of control? Voluntary control. You control them with your thoughts, right? Autonomic nervous system, you could say, is the automatic nervous system. It controls things in your body without your conscious thought. All right, so it's an autonomic nervous system that controls involuntary or self-governing systems in your body, like blood pressure. It'd be really nice maybe if you could control your blood pressure with your conscious thoughts, but you can't. It's controlled by your autonomic nervous system and your heart rate and digestion and urination, sweating and things like that. You can't turn your sweat pores on and off or sweat glands on and off. They just are controlled by your autonomic nervous system. Parts of your eye, like your pupil dilation or constriction, right, and all kinds of other functions, right? And so all of these functions are controlled by the three effector organs, which are smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands, right? So that's what the autonomic nervous system goes to. So let's compare autonomic with a somatic pathway. This is pretty good right here. Okay, so here we see four different neurons. Now, can anybody tell me the shape of this neuron right here? What shape is this? What are the three shapes of neurons that you have to know by Monday? You've got bipolar, you've got unipolar, and multipolar. Which one is this right here? This is a multipolar neuron, okay, because I see a bunch of short dendrites and one really long axon. All right, and this diagram right here, this first part, which to me kind of looks green, says somatic nervous system, which means that it's going to go to voluntary muscles and it's going to go to skeletal muscle. So it takes one neuron that starts in the central nervous system and it goes all the way to the effector organ, just one nerve cell going all the way. It also says that the neurotransmitter that's used at the neuromuscular junction is acetylcholine. That's the neurotransmitter. And anybody remember how acetylcholine is broken down so that a muscle can relax? It's called acetylcholinesterase within the synapse. Okay. And when acetylcholine is released on a skeletal muscle, it is always going to cause that muscle to contract. So it is stimulatory. It always is, right? Because when you command a muscle to contract, it can never make up its own mind whether it wants to contract or not. It just does what? It obeys your command and it contracts, right? As long as it's not damaged. All right, so that's the voluntary or somatic nervous system. Now, let's look at the autonomic nervous system. Remember, we got two divisions. We got parasympathetic and sympathetic. Now let's look and see how many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system to an effector organ for the autonomic nervous system. And what are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? We've got smooth muscle that's being represented by all of these organs right here in the digestive tract as they're squishing around all the time digesting food. So smooth muscle is one effector organ. The heart or cardiac muscle is a second kind. And the third kind is glands, right? So smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands make up the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system. So how are these controlled? How many nerves does it take? Here is a nerve cell body in the central nervous system. It leaves, all right? But notice it doesn't go all the way to the effector organ. It stops, and there's a synapse to a second cell. That second cell then goes to the effector organ. So all autonomic outflow pathways require one, two neurons. But what about a voluntary pathway? It is just one neuron all the way to the effector organ. So that's a nice distinction that you should know. So whether it's the sympathetic nervous system, we see one and two, or the parasympathetic, we see one and two neurons before it gets to the effector organ. Okay, so that happens in a ganglion because this ganglion is in the peripheral nervous system and it's just a group of nerve cell bodies. So it's a little bulge in a nerve fiber someplace like in the sympathetic chain or in other places in your body. The neurotransmitter that is used for both the sympathetic and parasympathetic is acetylcholine. And for the parasympathetic, it's acetylcholine. So both at the ganglion, both the sympathetic and parasympathetic use acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter, which is what? The same as the neurotransmitter for the somatic outflow pathway right here. Okay. So this is how we talk about these two neurons. Since this is a ganglion right here, the first cell is what we call a preganglionic fiber, and the second cell is what we call a postganglionic fiber. So in ganglia, the neurotransmitter is always the same. When acetylcholine is used as a neurotransmitter, we say that that neuron is a cholinergic fiber because it's using acetylcholine. So this somatic motor neuron is a cholinergic fiber, and both preganglionic fibers in the autonomic nervous system are cholinergic as well. Right, both the sympathetic preganglionic fiber and the parasympathetic preganglionic fiber are cholinergic because why? How would you explain that to somebody? Because they use acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter to carry the signal across the synapse. Okay. Let's look at this parasympathetic fiber or outflow pathway. Here is the postganglionic fiber and it goes then to the effector organ. And it releases acetylcholine as well. So what can you tell me about this postganglionic parasympathetic fiber? It is also what? Just like this one and this one and this one, it is cholinergic. It's a cholinergic neuron because it releases acetylcholine. Now let's compare that with the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so here's sympathetic nervous system, outflow pathway. What nerve fiber is this right here that I have the cursor on? That's the preganglionic fiber. It's cholinergic because it uses acetylcholine. Now, what kind of fiber is this one right here? That's the postganglionic fiber. Does it release acetylcholine? And you can see clearly not that NE represents norepinephrine. Okay? Norepinephrine is a different kind of neurotransmitter. So therefore, we can't say that the postganglionic fiber for the sympathetic nervous system is cholinergic. Because it uses norepinephrine, we have to say it is adrenergic. It's an adrenergic neuron. And I have that in the notes in the previous chapter, okay, and probably in this chapter as well. Okay, so you have cholinergic fibers and adrenergic fibers depending on the neurotransmitter that's used. All right, so the take-home message on this nice slide is that for voluntary or somatic control of your body to skeletal muscle, it takes one neuron. But for any autonomic outflow pathway, it takes two, right? And this area of the synapse right here is loaded with nerve cell bodies, so that's a ganglion. So therefore, we have a preganglionic fiber and a postganglionic fiber. At all ganglia, whether it's sympathetic or parasympathetic, the neurotransmitter that's used is acetylcholine. But for the postganglionic fiber, it's different, whether it's the parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system. For parasympathetic, it's acetylcholine, but for sympathetic, it's going to be norepinephrine. All right, so that's a pretty good introduction to the autonomic nervous system so far, and guess what? I'm going to have to go over that again, I'm sure, a couple of times, so I'm glad I had a chance to at least start today to do it. Okay, so after the test, maybe you get that pre-lecture reading assignment and go over some of that terminology again. All right, pre-ganglionic, post-ganglionic, and all of that kind of stuff. Okay. I don't have a really good answer. In a somatic pathway, it's always myelinated all the way to the effector organ. That's an advantage because it's fast. Okay. And for autonomic, one is not myelinated, probably because this is a much older nervous system that we inherited from very distant past in evolution, before the advantage of myelination was developed. Okay. That is my guess. Okay. Yeah.